Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This just came out. WikiLeaks. I love WikiLeaks.
President Trump in October of last year. And for those of you who like to say take him seriously, but not literally, The Atlantic magazine revealed yesterday that he really does love WikiLeaks, apparently, him and his kid. During the campaign and after, Donald Trump Jr. has had a correspondence with WikiLeaks that includes WikiLeaks acknowledging it was working with Russia to benefit the Trump campaign, Trump Jr. acceding to WikiLeaks' request to publicize a link to WikiLeaks with searchable information about Democratic emails, and Trump Jr. asking WikiLeaks for more information about dirt on Hillary Clinton that Trump operative Roger Stone had tweeted was about to come from WikiLeaks. Those are just some examples. WikiLeaks even sent Trump Jr. a message saying, "Great to see you and your dad talking about our publications." That was last October, the month before the election, right around the time Trump was saying things like this at campaign rallies.
Oh, we love WikiLeaks. Boy, they have really WikiLeaks. They have revealed a lot.
That was a separate incident of Trump saying he loves WikiLeaks from the first one we played. Trump CIA Director Mike Pompeo, by the way, calls WikiLeaks a hostile intelligence service. At this hour, Attorney General Jeff Sessions is beginning congressional testimony in an unrelated manner, but we expect he will be asked about the revelations in the Mueller investigation, and particularly the George Papadopoulos guilty plea to Mueller about campaign discussions regarding a Russian offer of dirt on Hillary Clinton that Sessions had not previously disclosed. Later in this program, once that testimony produces some answers, we will air some newsworthy highlights for you. My first guest today is New York Times columnist Paul Krugman. He's been writing detailed critiques of the Republican tax reform bills, now front and center in Congress, that Krugman derisively calls the Cut, Cut, Cut Act. Today's column is called Republican Class Warfare, The Next Generation. Hi, Dr. Krugman. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hi there.
The term class warfare, it's usually used to refer to working people promoting policies that vilify the rich. How are you using it?
Well, it's anything where one class seeks policies that, you know, benefit that class at the expense of others. And all of the really, really major class warfare that we've seen now for quite a while, for a couple of decades, has been top-down, not bottom-up. It's the wealthy, certainly Republicans allied with some of the wealthy, trying to redistribute income and wealth up towards the top. And what's going down through Congress is the most blatant effort yet. I never thought I'd be nostalgic for the Bush administration and its dishonesty about taxes, but they were pikers compared with these guys. And so it's really something. Just to say, by the way, it's amazing that this truly horrifying policy initiative is not only is the third worst thing happening right now, it's a fairly distant third behind, you know, the collaboration with a foreign power and sexual abuse, but it's important, so we got to stay on it.
The heart of your article today is about how you see the bill favoring inherited wealth over work, and specifically the heart of the article, making it harder for children of working and middle-class people to work their way up. Social mobility, one of the defining things of the American dream, the American middle class over time. One big one pertains to student loans. What would the House bill do to student loans?
It would end the deductibility of interest on those loans. So if you're coming from a working class family and presumably not being able to pay cash, you take out a student loan, well, guess what? You're never going to get a tax deduction on the interest on that loan. That's a huge departure. You know, there are various things. There are some interest deductions in the tax code that probably shouldn't be there or should be curtailed. But this one, if there's anything we should believe in, it is that we should be encouraging people to get an education, and that one goes away.
Listeners, your calls for Paul Krugman, welcome at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or tweet a question at Brian Lehrer. What about tuition breaks for children of university employees? You mentioned that.
Yeah, that's another amazing thing. It's been fairly standard practice. I mean, particularly at elite schools, one of the things that those schools do to make at least a slight gesture towards social mobility is that the children of their own employees, including, you know, catering staff, whatever, will get either zero or sharply reduced tuition. And that, under the bill, would become a be considered taxable income. So, by the way, if you are working your way through school and you have an employer, an enlightened employer that's willing to pay part of the cost of your education, that becomes taxable income. So all the various ways in which now, what's interesting here, this is cases where the private sector is, for whatever reason, trying to do good, trying to help promote the American dream. And the Republicans, they're against taxes, but if you're trying to help children from who aren't born wealthy, try to help them on their way up, well, that's taxable.
And how about grad students working their way through school as a teaching or research? I did that. When I went to grad school for journalism, I didn't have any money, so I only applied to schools where I might get a teaching assistant position to work my way through, which I did. What's going to happen to students like that today?
That began. The tuition break from regular tuition becomes taxable income. So that's a really big deal. It's a big deal, obviously, here at, I'm sitting in my office at CUNY at the Grad Center. It's a big deal for quite a few of our students who are getting tuition breaks, even more so when we're talking, again, about expensive elite schools that charge high tuition but are willing to waive that for students who really need the help and are willing to do some work as RAs or TAs. So amazing. Again, this is, and by the way, it's going to be really devastating for science technology graduate students, exactly the areas where we need to be trying to train people for the future, America's role in the next century. Well, hey, we're going to try and tax people out of that opportunity.
Why particularly heinous for STEM students?
Well, because they tend to spend a longer time. Their degrees take a long time to get, and the nature of science and engineering research is that it requires a lot of research assistance. So it's a very big deal in schools that do a lot of science and technology work, that research assistant jobs are an important part of the thing, and one of the main ways in which the whole system functions is that students in effect get on-the-job training by working as assistants while they are in school, and the payoff for them, even though it may take longer for them to go through, is that they get a tuition break, which again, all of a sudden becomes taxable income. So you're going to be starting to pay taxes as if you were employed in the field at a time when you're actually supposed to be building up the human capital to be able to participate.
New York Times columnist Paul Krugman, our guest. He's doing kind of a line-by-line critique of the House, and I guess we'll get to the Senate, tax reform bills in his recent articles. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Arturo in Colts Neck, you're on WNYC with Paul Krugman. Hello, Arturo.
Oh, hello. Good morning. From the leaked Trump tax return, federal, not the state, we know that the elimination of the alternative minimum tax will definitely help Trump in the tens of millions of dollars. My question is, who else is helped by the elimination of the alternative minimum tax?
Well, a lot of people whose income derives from things that is high income people who are not simply salaried, who have business type income, which in various ways allows them to take lots of deductions. We have the alternative minimum tax to prevent that from making it too easy to just evade taxes entirely, and we do away with that. And actually, there's an interaction here because both the House and the Senate bills include special new things for people who own businesses, oddly, people who own businesses but don't run them, because there are restrictions. So it's, but anyway, anyone who can find a way to make his income show up as business income could end up paying a quite low tax rate, and the alternative minimum tax would at least put some limits on that dodge, but they're going to get rid of that too if they can.
That one, so, that one Trump tax return from that one year that was leaked and showed him paying millions of dollars in taxes, almost all of that was because of the alternative minimum tax,
right,
wasn't it?
Yes, and we have no idea, of course, how representative that was. In fact, there is reason to believe that it, some of the are not going to do WikiLeaks, but there is apparently they were suggesting that he leak one tax return, presumably the one tax return that makes his position look least outrageous.
Yes, let me linger on this for a second, because that was part of what was in these Donald Trump Jr. WikiLeaks emails that were released yesterday. And yeah, WikiLeaks at one point suggested that the Trump campaign release 1 year of Donald Trump's emails through them, partly to confound the world, because then it would look like WikiLeaks wasn't just working on behalf of the Trump campaign, but the implication, as you say, was that they pick one kind of advantageous looking year and leak that one. And they didn't do it at that time, but they did do it later, or somebody did it later. David K. Johnston, the journalist who received the leak, of course, won't reveal his source and says he just got it in the mail, basically in a plain brown wrapper, which you know, probably true if David K. Johnston says it. But it's the suspicion all along has been that somebody related to Trump, pro-Trump in some way, leaked it because maybe it was the highest actual tax bill that he ever paid.
Yeah, and in any case, when we look, if you try to, you know, create a model of someone who would be hugely advantaged, it would be somebody who stands to inherit a lot of wealth, tax-free, because they'd repeal the estate tax, and who has a large stake in a business which can claim to be this, to get this special low tax rate for businesses, for family businesses, as long as you're not sort of actually running it, so.
Now, what does that mean? That was interesting to me in your column today, too. Can you explain that a little? A loophole that would benefit business owners as long as they don't actually run their business. What does that mean?
This, by the way, is a huge challenge for all those of us trying to write about it, because it's trying not to get too deep into the weeds. But basically, it says that if you have a business that is what's called a pass-through business, where under current law, whatever profit the business makes is just counted as part of your personal income, you can instead, and under the House bill, it's simpler, you can instead just have the business income taxed at 25% and owe no further taxes on it, which is a big deal if you're somebody who's in a high tax bracket. It means a big tax reduction. But then there's such obvious potential for abuse. Doctors, lawyers, any highly paid professional can declare themselves to be businesses and try and make it go away. So they set up rules that say that basically you must not spend too much time on this thing, so that you're not just a doctor pretending to be a business, but you're actually a business. But those rules have the effect of meaning that if you actually run your business, then you don't get the tax break. So it's only if you passively own a business, you own a business but somebody else runs it, that you get this. It's basically crazy. If you're going to set up an ideal type, an imaginary person, be somebody who stands to inherit a lot of wealth, inherit a large stake in a business that he doesn't actually run, so you can imagine an individual and just sort of, arbitrarily give that individual a name, call it Eric Trump. It's amazing how the bill really does look as if it's kind of crafted to minimize the taxes of a particular family.
Jenna in New Brunswick, you're on WNYC with Paul Krugman. Hi, Jenna.
Tuition remission, taxable income. I received tuition remission, full tuition remission for my undergraduate, and I still had to pay the sales tax and tuition fees, which came to about, $2,000 for a state school a year. It was not very much, but I still had to pay those taxes. How in the bill do they kind of get around how when you receive tuition remission as a child or under the care of someone who works at the university, how do they get around that? You know, how do you basically they're charging you double taxes? How do they justify that in the bill?
Well, I mean, right now there are some taxes, sales taxes, for example, to which you're subject anyway, but it's not considered part of your taxable income. So what we're doing is they're saying, okay, well, you've got these taxes you're already paying, but now we're also going to tax it. I mean, as a salaried employee now, I pay sales taxes, obviously, on everything I buy, and I also pay income taxes, which is fine. It's appropriate. It's not appropriate to be requiring income taxes on what is not actually income, is simply an effort by a school to make education available to those of limited means. So the double taxation isn't so much the issue. It is that we're taking something that ought not to be taxed, and we're taxing it, but only if you're, you know, it only for the people for whom it's likely to matter, which is lower income Americans.
And she talked about lower cost public university, but I think you were trying to say before that for somebody who potentially could go to an expensive private school and get their tuition waived because they're a graduate research assistant or teaching assistant, like Princeton, I think you're associated with, if that's a $40,000-$50,000 tuition bill and they get that covered, then that's considered $40,000-$50,000 of income under this bill?
Yes, exactly. It's a little bit limited. The undergraduates, it's a little unclear exactly how it would be handled. But for graduate students, definitely it would be considered taxable income.
And another education one, someone tweets, please mention that new tax bill wants to remove deduction for teachers who buy supplies for their students. Is that true?
I didn't know that, but it's quite possible. There's a lot in this bill. I think you just have to say that there's a lot of nickel and diming of stuff. All told, according to their own estimates, they're cutting about $95 billion out of education. So they really are targeting education, and obviously that's not going to affect the ability of wealthy people to get education for their children, but it's going to be a lot of cuts one way or another to the resources available for education of working class and middle class people.
If you're just joining us, Dr. Krugman's column today focuses on ways that he sees the House tax reform bill making it harder for children of middle and working class people to work their way up and have that social mobility that our country is or was famous for in this tax bill by making, you know, it more tax disadvantageous for them in particular while doing things like cutting taxes on the rich. Garth in Montclair, you're on WNYC. Hi, Garth.
Hi. I had a question for Dr. Krugman this bill is so complex that even I can understand it. As the owner of an S corp, I know that my taxes are not going to go up. I'm going to get a tax break. But I was thinking about the family of four who earns $96,000 a year and owns a home and itemizes their taxes, which is more or less what Gary Cohn had picked as his sample. And it seems to me that under current law, they probably itemize an average of about $24,000 in charity, mortgage interest, property taxes, and state and local taxes. That's like if they're living in Pennsylvania. And then they get personal exemptions on top of that. So right now they're writing off $40,600 of their income to get down to their taxable income. Under the new plan, there are no personal exemptions, and their itemizations don't exceed the standard deduction. So they're going down now to a $24,000 write-off. And they're essentially getting hit with a tax hike of $1,200 plus the rate hike in the first bracket. And, of course, they get a rate cut in the second bracket, but it all nets out if you itemize your taxes on average and you're a family of four with a $96,000 a year income, $80,000 adjusted gross income, your taxes are going up next year. And that's regardless of what they do with specifically with the state and local tax deduction. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, I mean, the example that I've seen worked through at some length is the 59,000, which is actually median family of four. So the typical family of four actually has an income of 59,000 right now. And Paul Ryan's been going around saying they get a big tax cut, which they actually do in the first couple of years because there are some additional child tax credits and various things that are thrown in, all of which go away. So that by the end of the 10-year period, that typical family, it isn't really typical, but you know what the Republican self-chosen typical family will end up paying significantly more in taxes. So the basically when you come down to the by the time the bill is fully phased in, about a quarter of the population would be paying higher taxes, and that. Specifically, that tends to fall on families with children. So about half of families that have children under the age of 18 would end up paying higher taxes under the bill. It's a tax increase on the middle and working class, especially for families with children. And they're trying to tell you something different about it, and they throw in a few lost leaders so that as long as they only refer to taxes in 2018 or 2019, it doesn't look quite so bad. But yes, taxes will go up for a lot of people. Unless you're well over $200,000 a year, there's a very good chance that you will be facing a tax increase.
Garth, thank you for your call. Let's step back a little bit from the individual provisions and really appreciate how detailed you get and go sort of line by line a clear way for a lay audience in your Times column. Let's take a step back to the big idea of the tax bill, which supposedly is that this is not just an across-the-board tax cut like the Bush tax cuts 15 years ago. This is an overhaul of the system designed to lower rates but close loopholes, which I think many economists on the right and left say is in theory a good idea. So do you support that type of reform in theory?
Yeah, in theory. But this is not that. I mean, the loopholes that are closed are tiny and tend to actually be benefits for the middle class. So this is nothing like that. It's nothing like, we had a tax reform that was actually like that in 1986. But this is nothing like that tax reform. And I will say that while I am in favor, if we could do that, if we could broaden the base and lower the rates, that would be a good thing. It's not a hugely important thing. I mean, everybody talks about the 86 tax reform as kind of the Garden of Eden of tax reform. It's all of the things that you were supposed to do, you really did. And if you look at what happened to the growth rate of the U.S. economy after that tax reform, the answer is nothing. You can't actually see it. I mean, the whole notion that taxes are a tremendous impediment to productive activity in the U.S. economy is actually not supported by any evidence. All of this claim that it's terribly important that we cut tax rates because taxes are a terrible disincentive for something or other is just, it's essentially an imaginary. It's something that you can, it's a story you can tell. It's not a crazy story in principle. It has zero support in the evidence, either from the United States or from other countries. So, yeah, sure, I'd be happy if we could get a real major tax reform that broadened the base and lowered the rates and made the whole thing much simpler. I wouldn't waste a whole lot of political capital on trying to make it happen. There are many, many much more important things that we should be devoting our attention to.
Now, the Senate bill has some differences with the House one, like it keeps the inheritance tax and also keeps the Obamacare individual mandate, for example, but it does away more fully with deductions for state and local income taxes. The House bill has a up to $10,000 exemption for property taxes. Do you like the Senate bill any better?
It's these differences, first of all, they're really pretty small change. Well, when you come down to it, they're basically similar bills. They're just pushing, they're rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic a little bit here. And the they're both terrible bills. And the truth is, there hasn't been time to figure out all of the implications of these things. And it's the people who are writing the bills have no idea what they're doing. This whole thing is being rushed through in indecent haste because they don't want to give anyone time to do a full analysis. So look, the Senate bill, is it better than the House bill? Maybe, maybe not. It's got some weird stuff in there. It's got some absolutely crazy incentives that come out of the way that the corporate tax cut is delayed while some of the other pro-corporate provisions are come in immediately. There would be some really bizarre tax arbitrage, crazy investments that would take place in the first year. So in some ways, the Senate bill is even more insane than the House bill. But, you know, this we're talking degrees of badness here. There's nothing good about either bill.
How about lowering corporate taxes? The idea is that U.S. companies pay higher rates. We want to be competitive internationally. And again, this is something that I think President Obama was sympathetic to and some other Democrats.
Yeah. And in fact, early on this year, Paul Ryan introduced a proposal for a destination-based cash flow tax, which actually has bipartisan support. There are Democratic economists who have advocated that kind of corporate tax reform. It died almost instantly because Republicans were opposed to the border tax adjustment that was an integral part of the bill. That would be an okay thing to do, but it's if you actually take the claims that pro-Republican think tanks, that's think in quotes, are making, they are insane. I have in front of me a spreadsheet in which I'm trying to figure out what the Tax Foundation, which is the most optimistic, is saying. And they seem to be claiming that we will be getting around $6 trillion of capital inflow over the next decade from the Senate bill, which is, first of all, a very implausible number. And secondly, if it was true, would also mean that we'd have an extra $6 trillion of trade deficit over the next decade, which somehow they failed to mention. And that would not be a good thing. It would actually, if their estimates were at all right, the Senate bill would be absolutely devastating to the U.S. manufacturing sector because we'd have a huge trade deficit, which would mostly come at the expense of manufacturing jobs. So, you know, the economic arguments here, to the extent that there's anything to them, there are all kinds of side effects which they don't want to tell you about.
Kevin in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Paul Krugman. Hi, Kevin.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to mention one part that I found particularly heinous as a permanently disabled individual, the elimination of the medical deduction tax. As someone who's stuck on a combination of Social Security and disability, the elimination of many of those deductions will make it very hard to live.
That's right. Medical expenses, you know, we have, even if you're insured, there tend to be a lot of medical expenses that aren't covered, and they are a really big deal for some people, I gather in your case. And ending the deductibility of medical expenses it's literally going to be deadly for some people because they simply won't be able to afford medicine that keeps them alive, and it'll be a horrible, horrible financial burden for others, all for not a whole lot of money, right? This is, compared with the cost of repealing the estate tax, the revenue you gain by taking away this deduction is not a big deal. So there's all these remarkable pieces of cruelty that are all there so that wealthy, children of wealthy parents can inherit their money either with no tax or, in the Senate case, with a greatly reduced tax.
So what you're describing is a big redistribution of wealth from toward the bottom to toward the top with, I guess when you give very wealthy people even a small percentage tax cut, that adds up to a lot of money. So you have to make it up with 1,000 small cuts lower down, which is what you're describing. Why would this be something Donald Trump would go for as the, forgotten working man, quote unquote, nationalist president? I mean, somehow I think Steve Bannon, even though he's hateful in so many other ways, was kind of an economic populist in theory. Like, this would not even be Bannonism, would it?
Well, Bannonism is a lot of talk about economic populism. We have yet to see, certainly from Trump and even from Bannon in reality, any actual populism. Everything that Trump has proposed or supported legislatively is anti-populist. It redistributes income and wealth upwards, not downwards. If we think about the what were supposed to be core parts of the agenda, you know, has anyone heard anything about infrastructure? You know, we're a year in and there's been nothing, no plan, no hint of a plan. We're seeing, I think one important kind of wonkish point here is that Trump has no policy apparatus. He has no experts. He has nobody around him who would be capable of actually writing a tax bill or an economic program. So he outsources all of that to Republicans in Congress. He outsources it all to Ryan and McConnell, who do the same old thing. It's just standard elitist Republican policies, and then Trump just signs off on it and declares it's great and it's wonderful and it's beautiful, and except maybe can we alter the legislation in ways that would give my family a little bit more of a tax break? So the whole populism thing, people were taken for a ride.
One last thing on the news. Trump is coming back from Asia. Are you a free trade advocate? Did you support TPP? Trump said again over there he wants two-nation trade deals, not regional ones, which he says more disadvantage the U.S. President Obama, of course, said TPP was to put the U.S. in the context of 12 Asia-Pacific nations so that China doesn't get to set the rules of the road for trade going forward. But, of course, a lot of progressives didn't like that deal either, Bernie Sanders, et cetera. Where are you?
So I was a soft TPP opponent. Not because for the most part, I am a free trader, not a religious one, but for the most part, I am. But TPP was not really about trade. The two really important things in TPP were intellectual property protection, so basically reinforcing the patent rights of pharmaceutical companies, and interstate dispute settlement, which would have enhanced the ability of corporations to sue governments for policies they didn't like. So now there were reasons. Obama wasn't being, you know, callous or stupid in pushing it. It was supposed to be more about diplomacy, about strategic positioning, than really about trade. But it was not a free trade deal. So, and the bilateral stuff, the idea that NAFTA was essentially a bilateral deal. If Trump thinks that those are so great, why does he think that NAFTA was the worst agreement ever made? So, no, this is, the main point is, of course, he has no idea what he's talking about. He just made this up. He has this sense that other countries are taking advantage of us, which is very, you know, sometimes happens, but it's not actually really the story. And we did. I have to say, the TPP is, I was against it, not strongly, because I didn't think it was the devil, but I was against it because I thought it was about the wrong things. But we are seeing China, in effect, stepping into the gap that we've left. To the extent that there are new trade deals being made, they are being centered on China, not on us. So we've ceded some leadership to another power.
Paul Krugman, New York Times columnist and professor of economics at CUNY these days. Today's column is called Republican Class Warfare, The Next Generation. Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we'll talk a little bit about the fifth woman to come forward with the most severe accusations yet against Judge Roy Moore as he runs for the Senate from Alabama, and the bigger picture on all of this that's going on now from Rebecca Traister from New York Magazine. She'll join us right after this.